This is Beyond Category, and I'm Eric Felton. We're here at the H Street Corridor in Northeast Washington, D.C., at the old Atlas Movie Theater, which is now the Atlas Performing Arts Center. And tonight, we're going to go in and check out the great baritone saxophone player, Gary Simoleon. Let's check it out. Thank you. Gary Smolian. Fantastic.
Thank you, Eric.
You know, I don't know if people hearing it either on radio or on their television get the full sense of the force of your sound on the baritone saxophone. It's really tremendous, like hurricane of sound.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much.
Well, you know, what's funny is you didn't start out as a baritone saxophone player. You started out on alto. How did you make that transition?
Yeah, well, I grew up playing alto saxophone and got a call when I was 22 years old to join Woody Herman's band. And Woody Herman's saxophone section, of course, is three tenors and a baritone, you know, the Four Brothers, classic Four Brothers sound. And I had never entertained the notion of playing the baritone ever. I was a die-hard alto player, always into Phil Woods, Cannonball, Bird, but, you know, changing to baritone would have presented an opportunity of going on the road with Woody, and there at that time they were traveling 50 weeks a year, and I had never had a gig like that on the road, so I grabbed the opportunity. It felt like the right thing to do at the time.
How did that phone call go? Somebody calls and says, do you want to play Barry Sax with Woody Herman, and you don't even own a Barry Sax at the time, and you say, sure.
Well, basically what it was I was playing with a great trumpet player from Long Island, Glenn Drews, who would join the band before me. And about 6 months later, after he joined the band, the baritone chair opened up, and he recommended me. And it was basically, that was it. It was a phone call, say, hey, you want to join Woody Herman's band? Meet us in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 2.5 weeks. And that's what I did. So I had two and a half weeks to prepare, and I bought a Yamaha baritone and took the train up to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and joined the band. And my first gig, sat down next to Joe Lovano. That was my trial by fire, May 25th, 1978, as a matter of fact. So, it was during those 2 years with Woody that I really grew to love the baritone and really never played alto after that.
Wow. So does your history of really your early days studying on alto affect how you approach the Barry saxophone?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't have much of an approach on the baritone saxophone when I first started, because I really never really listened to that instrument. I didn't really listen to baritone players so much, so I really didn't have much of a concept or a sound at all when I first started playing. But I did have vocabulary and I did have language, and I think that was what Woody Herman was attracted to, and that's why I stayed in the band for 2 years, considering that Woody Herman's pet peeve was alto players who played baritone. So I was really convinced every day for the first 6 months that I was going to be fired, because, like I said, I had absolutely no affinity for the instrument at all. Just, no sound, no concept of how to play the instrument, no voice. But I guess Woody heard something there that he liked, and during the 2 years I was with him, I really grew to feel that the baritone and not the alto was my real voice in music.
What makes the baritone your voice? How did that appeal to you ultimately?
Well, I just really feel like it's you know, when I play, it's a real, it culminates in the ability to express myself as a musician and as a person more really than the alto ever did.
Well, I'd like to hear you play some more. Why don't we get the band back up, and what are you going to play next?
We're going to play a blues by Lawrence Brown entitled Lawrence Brown's Blues.
Fantastic. Let's check it out.
Great. Thanks.
Tell me a little bit about your career as a musician these days. You've worked with all sorts of players, not just in a jazz context, but in pop context, everybody from Diana Ross and B.B. King, Ray Charles, to Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz. What do you get from playing with such a diverse and varied group of musicians?
Well, I consider myself really fortunate, and it's an honor to be able to play with all those great musicians that you mentioned. And just to be around their creative spirit and to be around their energy is such an inspiration, and just, you know, makes you want to just find a deeper place as a musician, because the level of expertise and the level of just their creative energy is so incredibly inspiring that that's just something that I just want to, if I could just get experience just a little taste of what they sound like and what they play like, I'd be really satisfied.
Are you able to find any particular inspirations in from Ray Charles or a pop star who really is doing pop at a high level that you can bring into a jazz context?
Well, you know, the thing is, they still, to them, music is really playing for the people. And I think a lot of jazz musicians, there's a tendency to kind of forget about that sometimes. It's like, well, you know, musicians, sometimes we play for each other and kind of forget that the audience is there. And so I think it's really important to kind of bring it back and to understand that, you know, music is still something that you have to reach out and touch people. You have to, you know, people, you want people to leave your performance really feeling good about what they hear it and what they experience. And you have a short period of time when you're playing for people to make their lives better. And so, you know, hearing people like you mentioned, B.B. King and Ray Charles and Diana Ross, I mean, they do that. You know, it's just, it's a beautiful characteristic about being a musician, you know, that in terms of what you give to the people, and I think that's really important.
Now, you do a lot of teaching, and once upon a time, jazz musicians learned a lot through kind of apprenticeship on the bandstand. You'd go to clubs, and you'd learn to play by sitting in with people, and that was always in front of an audience, so young players really would learn to sort of put a song across as they were learning to play. How, when you're teaching kids in the more, you know, formal setting of colleges and high schools and things, do you try to teach them about that part of the music?
Yeah, well, that's the challenge in music these days, except that, you know, the university and the conservatory has kind of taken the place of the bandstand. So I learned how to play on the bandstands, and so I try to bring that sensibility to my students, and with always remembering in the back of my mind of all the great people that helped me when I was younger. Like when I grew up on Long Island, and there were a lot of great musicians growing up, I mean, living on Long Island at the time when I was growing up, like the great tenor saxophonists from Detroit, Billy Mitchell, and Dave Burns, and Roy Haynes, and Sonny Payne from Count Basie's band. I mean, there was a real vibrant scene, and there were a couple of clubs where young people were welcome to play, and I always remembered that I had so many great teachers and so many people helping me growing up. Another great saxophone player named Joe Dixon, who's not really a household name, but played with Bunny Berrigan and was also an amazing teacher. So I really feel important to give back and to try and help students understand through my experience how to really kind of get them to become better musicians.
Well, I'd love to get some of that experience on the bandstand with you. Maybe we could play something together.
Yeah, why don't we play, sticking with the Duke Ellington theme of tonight, why don't we play In a Mellotone?
Fantastic. Let's
Great,
do
Eric.
It.
Beautiful. We'll be right back.
Oh, that was a blast, Gary. And Gary Smolian, we're joined by Mark Masters, who wrote the arrangements for the saxophone section tunes that we've been hearing tonight. Mark,
yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us about the project, this saxophone,
well,
Ellington saxophone section project.
Ellington Saxophone Encounters. And Jimmy Knepper, who we had in common as a friend, was really at the root of all this. After Jimmy passed, his daughter called me, said, come, he donated all of his materials to the nonprofit that we run. And I'm looking through all of his music, and there's a stack of lead sheets, tempo music, songs by Jimmy Hamilton, Paul Gonsalves, Johnny Hodges, and so I get this idea.
Those are all guys who were saxophone players in the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
And so I get this idea, Gary and I should have this, we should do a project with Ellington's music by Ellington saxophone players. And here we are, and we did it.
You know, Gary, those sax players, such amazing players in Ellington's band, who aren't necessarily always remembered for their great contribution. You know, what do you take away from players like Johnny Hodges and Paul Gonzalez, and of course on Barry Sax, Harry Carney?
Well, where do you start? I mean, it's just, you know, the thing about Ellington saxophone section that was so beautiful is that as individuals, they had such incredible voices, but when they played as a section, it was just a whole other level. I mean, that was really one of the classic, beautiful ensembles in this music, is the Ellington saxophone section from that period. There's nothing more beautiful than that for me.
And Mark, as you were digging into the Ellingtonia to do these arrangements, did you find any of the secrets of how Ellington would get that sound out of the sax section?
Well, one of the things he did is he put, you got four voices and five instruments, and normally everybody puts the baritone on the bottom, doubles the alto, the melody down an octave. He put Harry Carney's distinctive voice as the fourth voice down, and Paul Gonzalez playing tenor was doubled the octave, an octave lower than Johnny Hodges, which is, it's a little bit of Ellington mystery. But when you start to listen to the stuff and you know that and you listen for it, you hear why Harry Carney, why he was so beautiful in there. He had his own voice, not just the melody down an octave.
Right. And, you know, and also, as a baritone player, sometimes playing in a big band can be less than rewarding because you're playing roots and you're playing, you know, some of the not always an interesting part. But the great orchestrators like Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn and Thad Jones and Dave Holland and people who know really how to understand how to write for saxophones really use the baritone in a very interesting way. And it doesn't get boring or it doesn't get just tiring because you always have a great note in the chord when you play those arrangements.
And Harry Carney, he played with Ellington probably longer than anyone else, starting in the 1920s.
And joined in 27 and played, was with the band until his death in 75, mm-hmm. I think, right?
And Harry Carney died not long after Ellington,
right.
And was said that he died of a broken heart after Ellington.
Oh, he said he had nothing to live for, you know.
Well,
and the two of them rode together in a car all those years.
Right, the rest of the band
guys
was on
the bus. And they rode in a car. Harry drove and Duke sat
paid the tolls.
Yeah.
Well, happily, something to live for is this fantastic music that comes from Duke Ellington, from the members of his band, and now in this version with saxophone. Why don't we finish out with, I think you had a great tune that Johnny Hodges used to be a big feature for him in the Ellington band. What are you going to finish up with?
Yeah, we're going to play Jeep's Blues.
That was, of course, at the Newport Jazz Festival, one of the great tunes in that triumphant show.
Yeah, that's a beautiful record, by the way.
Well, Mark Masters, Gary Simoleon, thanks so much for joining us, and let's close things out with Jeep's Blues.